What I want to look at in this week's parasha Vayechi is really perhaps the central scene in the parasha. The central scene in this week's parasha is Yaakov calling his sons together around his deathbed and giving a bracha. And bracha is kind of a loose term here. But he does speak to each one of them and say things to them which are of a nature of destiny and task and assignment. The reason that we think of it as a bracha is because of the last pasuk on page 1. So take a look at it after he concludes all of them in order, and we'll see what that order is with Binyamin. He says, "Kol ela shiftei Yisrael shnei masar." Right, this is Shiftei Yisrael. Now, Shiftei Yisrael is clearly an anachronism. It's not Shiftei Yisrael, it's Yaldei Yisrael, it's Bnei Yisrael. It's the Jacobson family, right? But this is now from a perspective of Har Sinai, called Shiftei Yisrael. V'zot asher diber lehem aviyem vayivarech otam, ish asher kevirchato berach otam. So there's a machloket rishonim here, whether or not this means these things that we're going to study now are the brachot, or does it mean, besides all these things, some of which are closer to a Mishaberach, besides that, he also gave brachot? Because some of these things, it's kind of hard to read as brachot unless we really broaden the meaning of brachot. But what I want to look at is more specific here than to the meaning of bracha, and to ask essentially two questions. What is the rationale behind the order here, which is something that we always ask whenever we have the lineup of 12, because the lineup of 12 is rarely done in age order, in birth of sequence. I don't think it ever is. And so we ask at the beginning of Bamidbar, and then we ask when we come to the 12 scouts, and then when we get to the census in Pinchas, and then we ask the question, when we get to the list of the 12 Nesim in Masei. Every time we ask, why is it in that particular order? All right, we ask the question, and Vzot HaBracha, where the order seems to be mixed up again, of the order of the sons or of the Shvatim. So I want to take a look at the order. So before looking at the text itself, let's look at the order. The order here is Reuven, Shimon, and Levi together, which is also something to look at, Yehuda. And so far, by the way, Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda is dead on, exactly in order, right? Who should be next? You have really two choices. Who should be next? Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, who should be next? Either Dan, if you're going to go in birth order, or Yisachar, if you're going to go with the Leah thing, which is like the last time that we saw a list, which was last week, and we talked about that list, of the emigres coming down to Egypt. The order was the children of Leah in order, and then the children of Zilpah, and then like that. But here, it's a little bit different. They, for some reasons, Vulun and Yisachar get switched. All right, so you could say, all right, the list is perfect, except, and you got to wonder why. But then it gets a little bit stranger. Dan comes next, and I sort of get that we're doing Beit Leah, and then Zilpah, but the problem is, Dan was born of whom? Bilhah. Which means Dan is part of the Rachel house. So, what's Dan doing here? And if you're going to do Dan, who should come next? Naphtali, his brother. Instead, it's Gad. Then it's Asher, and then it's Naphtali. So if you want to get kind of sort of structural about it, you could say, okay, these four, who by the way have another thing in common and unique in this bracha, which we'll take a look later when we look at the text, you could say that these four are presented in chiastic order. Okay, Dan and Gad are the firstborns of their respective mothers. And so it's Bilhah, Zilpah, Zilpah, Bilhah. Okay, but why? Like, what's the point of that? It's nice, nice observation, but who cares? And so the order here seems to really not make much sense. And then at the end, Yosef, who gets a lot of billing, and then, as looks like almost an afterthought, Binyamin, the reason I say it that way is because if you look at the parasha, the way that it's laid out in the Torah is that Binyamin, there's a parasha p'tucha, Binyamin, and then without any break whatsoever is the summary and continues on. They open up a Sefer Torah. Take a look. You'll see These brachot are broken up into parashot p'tuchot and stumot, and I did this based on the Aleppo Codex. I took out my Aleppo Codex last night, or my Ketur Shalayim, and I parsed this out based on that. And then you'll see that after Yosef, Binyamin, and all the rest are all in one parashah. Binyamin and then what follows is all in one parashah. So it's a little strange. And the strange piece about it is, what's the division here? But the larger question, because sequence is a nice thing to talk about, and maybe we can discover here and there little nuances, but the bigger thing to talk about is, what is Yaakov trying to accomplish here? Is Yaakov trying to give tasks to different sons? Well, if that's the case, first of all, Yosef, who's very big here, doesn't get a task. Some of the others don't get a task. Is Yaakov trying to assign them land or territory, which he does for some of them, but he doesn't do that for others? So what is this scene about? The scene, which is the central scene in Vayechi, and sort of the culmination of everything we've been working on since Lech Lecha, what's the whole scene about? So let's read it through. We'll ask some questions along the way. See if we can figure it out. Vayikra Yaakov abanav, vayomer, yasfu v'yagid alachem et asher yikra etchem b'acharit hayamim. Now here's where anachronistic approach becomes very problematic. Yaakov summons them together and says, now I'm going to tell you what's going to happen b'acharit hayamim. Now, with full knowledge of Tanakh, meaning from the perspective of the Tanakh's already been completed and we're familiar with the terminology used, what does acharit hayamim mean? What does acharit hayamim mean?
Could it mean after I die?
What does it mean? I'm saying, if you study Tanakh, what does acharit hayamim mean? It means messianic era, right? Vayah be'acharit hayamim nachon yeh har beit Adonai. Right, we have acharit hayamim in several places in Tanakh, and they always refer to the end of history, whatever that means, the culmination of history. Acharit hayamim. And so, therefore, we automatically look at this and we say, because we read Tanakh synchronously, and that's appropriate for midrashic purposes. In other words, we read Tanakh as if Tanakh is all produced at the same time, and therefore we say words have similar meanings, and you get an exer shavah from a word in Bereishit and Divrei Hayamim, and it works together. For midrashic purposes, that's fine. But we have to stop and ask, what does acharit hayamim mean here? Now, if acharit hayamim, and this is where there's a critical divide, if acharit hayamim was a word in the narrative, then I would ask one question. But since it's a word in a dialogue, it becomes a different question. Now explain. If acharit hayamim, as an example, is a word in the narrative, then what I have to ask is, what does acharit hayamim mean to the first people reading that narrative? Who are the first people reading that narrative? Who's the first audience of this narrative? B'nai Yisrael at Har Sinai. Or B'nai Yisrael at Moav. We don't have reason to think that Sefer Bereishit, as is, was already a completed Sefer before B'nai Yisrael became enslaved, or during the slavery. Right? We have certainly reason to believe that B'nai Yisrael were familiar with family stories, and much of this may have been Pal Peh, but no reason to think that there was a Sefer Bereishit around during that time. So we have to assume that the first readership is the readership of Bnei Yisrael in the Midbar at some point, whenever Moshe gives them the Torah. Right? Har Sinai, or Moab, whatever. But if it's dialogue, it becomes a different question. Because now we have a record of what Yaakov actually said to his sons. So he said to his sons, let me tell you what's going to happen in acharit hayamim. So if we think that Yaakov actually said these exact words, we got to think, well, what would acharit hayamim mean to his 12 sons? If, on the other hand, we're approximating his words, or he was speaking a slightly different language and we're updating it, then the question becomes moot. But either way, the question has to be relevant for a group no later than Har Sinai, maybe no later than the Midbar, maybe earlier. What does acharit hayamim mean to them? Because they don't know Sefer Yeshayahu, and they may not even be familiar with the notion of an end of history and a changed world, etc. As far as they're concerned, we're marching into Eretz Canaan. We're going to conquer it. We're going to build a mikdash. Machon l'shivtacha pa'alta anunai. And then whatever else we're going to do. But there isn't like a sense in the history. Yeah, Jason.
I mean, considering that in the beginning of the Parsha, it talks about Yamim, the days of his life.
Where does it say that?
When it's talking, maybe it was last week when it's talking about the I thought it was by Yaakov. Or maybe it's the number of years that he was living in Mitzrayim.
Yeah, okay. The first
Pasuk. Uses the word Yemei as a number of days of one's life, that Ahayim could just be the end of my life.
Yeah, but then he would say
it. Then the future there.
Then he would say it like, I mean, I don't think you're far off, but I think in the words, I don't think it works. Then he would say it like Yosef says it, which is, I'm going to die, and then in the future something's going to happen. Is a little bit benign. Let's take a look. Okay, so what would it mean, though, to this group? Acharit Hayamim doesn't mean when I die, because there's way better ways to say when I die. But what does Acharit Hayamim mean to this group? Because this group, again, is not necessarily familiar with or thinking about an end of history and some cataclysmic or Armageddon or whatever kind of apocalyptic kind of picture.
It seems to me also the positive that they're Acharit Hayamim, not his. Asher Yikra Etchem.
Very good. Right. Asher Yikra Etchem be Acharit Hayamim. Very good. So it'd be like, what will affect you be Acharit Hayamim. So what's Acharit Hayamim? So I think the simplest explanation, it's not far from what Jesus is, I think the simplest explanation is, let me tell you what's going to happen with time. Here we are, we've just settled into Egypt, we're going to be here for a while, let me tell you what's going to happen with time. Now, with time, I think it's going to be further than just their days, is going to be related to them, not just as individuals, but as heads of family. How do I know that they already view themselves as heads of family? Because I saw it last week in the descent to Egypt, right? Is that each one was reckoned with their kids and their households, etc. These are heads of family. So what's going to happen with these families down the pike? And the reason I mention that is because Rashi brings a very famous midrash here, which is that originally Yaakov wanted to legalot et haketz, to reveal the end of days, meaning the messianic era or whatever you want to call it. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu didn't want him to do it. So that's why he switches his topic here to something more mundane or more temporal. But it's not necessarily read that way. There's no reason to think that Yaakov switched here. He said, listen to me, and then he immediately starts in. Reuven b'chori ata. Now, what does he say to Reuven? Okay, you're my b'chor. Kochi v'reshitoni. Yeter seit v'yeter az. You are the one who's strong. You've got this advantage. But, pachas kamayim. You are hasty like water. Al totar. And as a result of that, you have not gained the advantage. In other words, the advantage you should have had of being the Bechor, you lost. What happened? You went onto your father's bed. This is pointing to his sin with Bilhah. However you read the sin, whether it's having relations, whether moving the bed, doesn't matter. Bottom line is he acted hastily in the sexual politics of his father. Az chilalta yitzui Allah. And Steiner wrote an interesting article about what Allah here means. It could have to do with nursing. But you violated the bet. All right, so Reuven, you're the Bechor, but you lost it. Why is he saying this here? In other words, if he's saying, I'm going to give you a bracha, well, again, this is more of a mishaberach. If on the other end he's saying, let me tell you what your job is, well, he didn't tell him what his job is. He just told him what job he lost. So it's a little unclear. We all understand the consequences, but we don't understand what's doing here. In other words, if he wants to cut Reuven out, he can go straight for the guttural and say, Yehuda, you're in charge. It's not straight for the guttural, straight for the jugular, sorry. He can go straight for the point and say to Yehuda, you're in charge. And everybody else will figure out what happened to Reuven. Anyway, and leave him out. And it gets worse or more intense as we look. Shimon v'Levi Achim klei chamas mechirotahem. Shimon and Levi, he lumps together. Achim. Which, of course, alludes back to Vayikhu Shimon v'Levi Achei Dina. Right? The whole Shechem episode. Right? And they have weapons of violence. B'sodam al tavon afshi, b'kalam al tichad kvodi. I don't want to be involved with their councils. Right? Kivyapam hargu ish v'tzodam ikru shor. Some Midrashim read that shor is actually an allusion to Yosef, the Bechor Shor, that they had to play a role in that. Whether that's something that Yaakov knew about or not. Arura pam ki az, he doesn't curse them, he curses their anger. And then what's the result? Achalkem bi Yaakov, afitzem bi Yisrael. So I'm going to spread them out. Shimon and Levi are going to be spread out. Which, of course, in reality is the way it plays out. Neither Shimon or Levi get any land. Levi gets no land whatsoever. And they get cities which are given to them by Bnei Yisrael. And Shimon is given cities by Yoshua, but the cities are inside of Yehuda's land. So neither one of them has land, and they're nowhere near each other, and Levi's all over the place, so they're all spread out, and the sense seems to be, you guys are dangerous, and so I can't let you be together, and this is what I'm doing. But again, the question is, so what's the point of this gathering? What is he trying to accomplish that we've said, I'm going to tell you what's going to happen by Acharit Hayamim, and now he hasn't told them what's going to happen, he's told them what he's stripping them of. I'm stripping you of leadership, and I'm stripping you of land. Okay, good. I still don't get it.
Is it totally a rebuke, or is there something positive in Achal
Kem? Achal Kem, yeah, it seems to be a full rebuke. Because it's also a response to a rebuke. Meaning it's the follow-up from a rebuke, which is, you guys are men of violence, and I don't want to be included in the council. Anything of that sort.
Because of them, they had that land also, no?
What?
Because of them, they had the land of Shem.
You could certainly advance that argument. They were the first ones to actually do any conquest in the land. Correct. But he seems to turn on that. Then again, a very interesting question, which is not part of what we're doing, about is why Yaakov waited till now to rebuke them. Why didn't he rebuke them then in Shechem, instead of just saying, you've hurt us in the eyes of the locals, why doesn't he come out with this much stronger moral rebuke? And there's a lot of discussion about that. And then Yehuda, now notice I put them in a red, right, because these guys are red out of the well. These guys are redliners. Yehuda, who I put in purple. Atayo ducha checha. Yadcha ba'orfoivecha. Yishtachavu lecha b'nei avicha. So what does he do with Yehuda? And we talked about this, I think, 2 years ago. Yehuda has been elevated because your brothers acknowledge you. 2 years ago, I suggested that achecha here doesn't mean your brothers, because they're covered in the next part of the pasuk, but rather your treaty partners. Because Yehuda is somebody who builds treaties with people in Israel, in Timnah, and so Yehuda has created an alliance, just like Avraham did, and therefore that's part of the reason he's reached greatness. He doesn't take the position of Shimon and Levi, which is offense and violence, but rather building coalitions. And Yadcha Ba'orafoyvecha, as a result of that, you can control the neck of your enemies because you got people helping you. Yishtachavu lecha b'nei avicha, and therefore your brothers will all acknowledge you and bow to you. Gur Aryeh Yehuda, Miterek b'nei alita, Karatvatz Kayir, Aryeh Chlavim Yekimanu, Yehuda is mighty and powerful like a lion. Lo Yasur Shem Yehuda, Mechokek Menu Aglav, that the leadership will never leave from Yehuda. And in here, for the first time, we seem to be hearing about a positive assignment. Ad ki yavo shilo v'lo yikatamim, and we've talked at length about Ad ki yavo shilo. Osirila gefen iro v'la sorika b'ni atono ki b'es b'yan v'shom damani m'suto chachli v'yanayim yan v'len shina michalav, in which he seems to be now given land which is ripe with grapes and with grazing. And therefore there's going to be milk of goats and there's going to be wine of grapes. And that, of course, is Gush Etzion, Hebron, you know, that whole area, which is Baruch Hashem is lots of vineyards. All right. So again, we're confused about what the purpose of this gathering is. Zvulun lechof yamim mishkon. Zvulun is going to be at the sea. Vulechof oniot v'yachato al Sidon. And he's going to have extension all the way to Sidon. Sidon is a city we all know about at the time. The interesting thing is that Zvulun, who here seems to be given a mandate of being the merchant marine, as it were, is the only tribe that's fully landlocked in reality. Kind of a weird thing on a map, but it's what it is. Yisachar Chamor Garim. Now, whether it's a compliment or not, but Yisachar is a donkey. Rovetz bin Amishpatayim, Vayar Menuchaki Tov et Arts Kinaima, Vayet Shivon Lisbol, Vayilam Asoved. And the general description of Yisachar here is somebody who is hard worker and just puts his nose to the grindstone and does the work. Right, just diligently. Dan yadir amo kachad shivtei Israel. He dan nachash ale derech hashfon ale orach hanusrech lipeisus veiporach v'achor. And here suddenly Dan is being introduced. And again, why Dan is next is introduced as some sort of ambush guy on the road. And then suddenly in the middle, he turns and says lishuat chakiviti adonai. Is that part of Dan? Is that a separate thing in the parshiot? It's part of Dan. Unclear. And then Gad Gedud Yigudanu Hu Yigudu Akev. By the way, notice that if all four of the Bnei Ashvachot, there's lots of wordplay. Danya Dinamo, Gad Gedud Yigudanu, Me'asher Shmeina Lachmo. And Naftali noten imrei shefer. Right? So every one of them has deliberate wordplay in their names. God is going to set up army tents. So as opposed to Dan, who's like the underground, the militia guy, God is the army guy. Me'asher shmeina lachmo v'yitein madanei melech. Notice that Asher is going to be the one who's going to give all of the sweet things. He's going to have a very rich land with lots of sweets and bring sweets to the king. Naftali ayalash tuchar oteni meshafer. Naftali is the post office. We know that picture, right? Naftali is the deer who goes fast and brings nice words. And then we get Yosef. Long bracha of Yosef. It's a little hard to decipher what that is. And then the bracha and Binyamin. I put them in a different color. Question is, what's going on? I mean, I understand putting Yosef Binyamin last. I understand putting Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda first. But it's in the middle. I get a little bit confused with the order. But then, I look at the text. I say, I don't know what's going on here. Are they being assigned? Are they being given land? Are they being stripped? Are they being confirmed? What's happening? So, turn the page, and appreciation to Elliot for printing this. It's hard to print one side portrait, the other side landscape. But I think what Yaakov is doing here is he's establishing lechatchila the possibility of two parallel groups of leadership. Now, you would think that if we were to divide the house of Yaakov into two groups, it would be Beit Leon, Beit Rachel, and what we saw last week in the groups coming down. And Beit Rachel would include Dan and Naphtali. That's not what Yaakov does. Yaakov has two different groups of leadership, and we'll see why. The group of leadership which focuses around Yehuda, who he installs very deliberately as a leader. And by the way, notice, Yehuda alone has five psukim. Is that true that he alone has five psukim? It's not true, because Yosef also has five psukim. So he's installed two kings here, two leaders of the family. He's got one family led by Yehuda, one family leading, that's Yehuda. And he has built a kingdom around Yehuda. Please take a look at the chart and you'll see that now the order hopefully will make some sense. Who's first is Reuven, Shimon and Levi, and then Yehuda. Why does he put Shimon and Levi together? Well, the easiest explanation is that their condemnation is because of what they did together. And it's their togetherness that's the problem. Something else going on also. He presents Yehuda as the king, but he's got to do something else first before in front of his sons. He's got to justify why number four is number one. This entire parsha is about one thing, and that is establishing the future future leadership model. So the first thing he's got to do is explain why Reuven, Shimon, and Levi are not getting it. What's the reason Reuven doesn't get it? Because a leader has to be deliberate, has to be somebody who can deliberate with his brothers and take counsel and take time and think about things, as opposed to acting hastily and acting on his own. Loose cannon can't be a leader. Shimon and Levi. What's Shimon and Levi's problem? Shimon and Levi's problem is that they think that the solution to the problem is violence. And by the way, also acting without counsel, on their own, taking it into their hand, and violence. So Yaakov has to explain to his sons why they're not getting it. Not just that they're not getting it, there's a reason they're not getting it. So who does get the leadership? Yehuda. What's the first reason Yehuda gets the leadership? Because I'll tell you, ducha chacha, because you've got the loyalty of your brothers. And you got loyalty of these treaty partners. You've known how to create leadership by example. And so these people follow you. That's the first thing you need for leadership. You have to have people who will coalesce around you and will follow you into battle, follow you into a new land, whatever it may be. The second piece of the puzzle is that Yehuda is somebody who has worked and created partners as opposed to using violence as the answer. Okay, so we understand why Yehuda is there. Now, who's next? We have Zvulun. What's Zvulun's job? And again, it doesn't play out this way, but it doesn't matter. What's Yaakov presenting Zvulun next? Because what's Zvulun's job? Zvulun is in charge of export. He's the one who's going to be traveling to a distance. He's not presented as a navy. He's presented as a merchant, marine. Okay? Merchant sail. Who's next? Yisachar. Now notice that Yisachar, in this scheme of looking at the 10 sons who are not Yosef Binyamin, and looking at them lined up against each other, Yisachar is lined up opposite Reuven. Why? Why is Yisachar getting the special land he's getting and getting the praise he's getting? Because what is he? He is somebody who puts himself to the task and works diligently the exact opposite of Reuven. He's presented as the exact opposite. Instead of being hasty, he's slow to work, does one thing at a time, doesn't give it up, and continues his work like a loyal donkey. Who comes next? Dan and God. Why are Dan and God put together? And by the way, Dan and God, as you could see, are put together in, is it one parsha? No, there's a stuma there. But nonetheless, Dan and God are put together. Why? What do they have in common? They're both about army. Dan is the commando, if you will, and God is the regular forces. As opposed to Shimon and Levi. Shimon and Levi don't have the Malah of Dan, who can wait by the side of the road like a snake and then attack in a smart ambush. And they don't have God, who has a big army setting up with a gedud. But rather, they just take their swords and go violent. Right? A little trickery, and that's how it's been portrayed. So what is it that Yehuda needs? Yehuda needs an army. What kind of army does he need? He needs an army of people who work together, who work under him, and to work in an organized fashion that's going to be smart for the army. Now, Asher is an interesting fellow. How is Asher described? Asher is described as having a very rich land. And what is Asher described as doing? Bringing sweet things to the king. He's the only one who's got a king mentioned. You see why? Because he's facing the king. He's also the one who's bringing those sweet things to the king. And then who's last? Naphtali. Who's Naphtali? Naphtali is Zvulun's land partner. Look at it. Zvulun is the one who travels by sea, and Naphtali is the one who travels by land. And so what does the king have around him? The king has around him diligent workers, a real army, both of the commando and regular forces. He has the luxuries of a king which are needed. Look at Melachim Aleph Perek Ein, the description of Shlomo's wealth, or Perek Tet. And he also has a foreign office. He also has export. He also has international relations. And it's all set up elegantly by Yaakov. Does this mean, Zvulun, you've got to go to sea? Not necessarily. Some of it's about land. So Zvulun evidently was originally supposed to get Haifa north, which is, by the way, why Yochanan is more Tzayzor Zvulun. Interesting. Even though Zvulun's land is further in, we still keep a notion that Zvulun's there. Zvulun's supposed to be all the way to Sidon. Where's Asher? Asher is up in the north also, with all the sweet olive oil and everything that's there. So in other words, they're given particular areas which are beneficial for what they're supposed to be doing, but he's also calling on their particular talents. So again, why are Reuven, Shimon, and Levi mentioned? To tell us why they're being ousted, because that's why Yisachar, Dan, and Gad are being included the way they are, because they are the proper form of that. And that's all Beit Leah, and Beit Leah now encompasses also Dan and Naphtali, all 10 of them. Who are the only two who are not included? Yosef Binyamin. Yosef Binyamin is a different model. And so Yosef Binyamin is what we call Beit Rachel. Now, an interesting piece to the puzzle is that even though once we come into the land, this all gets jumbled up, and one of the biggest jumbles happens because Reuven and Gad ask for land on the east bank, so the whole map gets gerrymandered. But eventually we end up with who is the powerful kingdom in the south? It's Yehuda. And who's the powerful kingdom in the north? It's Ephraim. It's Yosef. And interesting enough, who is always in the middle of that is Binyamin, who both is geographically in the middle, and also the whole story of Shaul and David, everything and all that in the middle, the whole story of Mephibosheth. What Yaakov has also done is to set up two different models of kingdom. Take a look at the bottom of the page. You see that that Shaul, when he was first named as king, has some struggles in confirming and affirming his leadership, and he has people who oppose him. Take a look at David, on the other hand, from Beit Leah. Everybody's already in love with David before he's king. He has almost the opposite reality than Shaul. Shaul is named king when the people want a king, and the king, people say, "Ah, oh, who is this guy? And he's not going to help us at all." And he has a difficult time kind of establishing himself. David, on the other hand, is already the people's choice before he's king, while he's still working under Shaul. Part of the reason for that is, how does David spend all of his years when he's on the run, which is after this? He spends all his years establishing alliances and followers in Yehuda. That's the model of Yehuda. And that's the model that already was established here by Yaakov and mapped out in this bracha around the deathbed, which ultimately led to the successful leadership of Beit David.